Welcome to a new episode of the Activism Academy podcast with me, Miriam Fanin. First of all, welcome to our new co-host, Eva Callanan. Today, we will continue our series on far-right extremism, focusing on the Canadian extremism landscape. We are joined by Dr. Barbara Perry, the director of the Center of Hate, Bias and Extremism, who has written extensively in the area of hate crime and right-wing extremism. Our second guest is Phil Gursky, president of the Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. Phil has been working for more than a decade with the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. Welcome everybody to a new episode. Welcome to our guests. And we also have the pleasure today to have a new host with us. Eva, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey everyone, my name is Eva and I work with the Activism Academy. I'm based in Ireland and this will be my first time co-hosting with Miriam and co-hosting any podcast, in fact, so I'm very excited. Thanks, Miriam.
And on to our guests, would you like to say a couple words about yourselves and your work?
Ladies first.
Who are you calling a lady? hi there, everyone. I'm Dr. Barbara Perry. I am a professor in the Faculty of Social Science and Humanities at Ontario Tech University, where I'm also the director of the Center on Hate, Bias, and Extremism. So really happy to be here this morning, or this afternoon, or this evening, whenever you happen to be listening to us.
Hi there. My name is Phil Gursky. I am jointly the president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting and also the director of the National Security Program at the University of Ottawa's Professional Development Institute. But I think more importantly, for the purposes of this podcast, and I'm thrilled to be here today, is I spent 32 years in security intelligence in Canada, divided between signals intelligence or SIGINT and human intelligence. And my most recent experience in intelligence is looking at Islamist extremism in Canada from an investigative perspective, from a practitioner perspective, working on hundreds of cases in my country, and have been able to parlay part of my experiences into 6 books on terrorism, including the most recent, which is Look at the History of Terrorism in Canada from Confederation to the Present, called The Peaceable Kingdom. And I am thrilled to be here with Barb, and I feel already that I feel under advantage because on the topic that we're going to talk about today, largely, Barb is the person in Canada, and I am most certainly not that person. So advantage, Barb, right from the outset.
Phil, I'm going to start with you, but the question is really for the both of us. So given your very long experience in the field of terrorism, how have you seen the evolution of terrorism in general since the 90s and now, and how has the landscape changed?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, Miriam. And, you know, when the Security Service was created back in 1984 out of the old RCMP Security Service, it was very much a security intelligence service that was focused on counterintelligence. This, of course, was during the Cold War still. The Soviet Union was still around and its allies, and most of the investigations that we were involved in were looking at Soviet influence in Canada. Of course, the wall fell in 89, you know, the Soviet Union dissolved in 91. But even in the 1980s, we were looking at a variety of terrorist movements in Canada that seemed to have slipped from memory of late. We had, of course, the number of attacks by Armenian extremists who were trying to kill Turkish diplomats in retribution for the 1916 genocide against Armenians by the dying days of the Ottoman Empire during World War I. We had Air India in 85, which before 9/11 was the single greatest act of terrorism in history, at least aviation history. And that was planned and perpetrated by Canadian Sikh extremists who were seeking to punish India for its inability to grant an independent Khalistan to Sikh Indians. As the late 80s morphed into the 90s, we found that we were starting to look at things, what we then called Sunni Islamic terrorism, we now call Islamist terrorism. This, of course, is the aftermath of the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan in 89, the rise of Al-Qaeda. And we were seeing Canadians, for example, join the jihad in Bosnia, trying to fight against Serbian and Croats who were killing Bosnian Muslims. Around the same time, we also looked at the Barb's area, the far right, in the 90s. We had a lot of investigations in that regard. Didn't find a lot of great seriousness in terms of plots, in terms of groups. And I think we kind of dismissed them in the late 90s. And then, of course, 9/11 happened and it became all jihadis all the time for the better part of the 2000s and 2010s. That has changed significantly in the past 4 to 5 years for events that are probably tied mostly to the January 27 attack at a mosque in Quebec City by a Canadian far-right terrorist, I would call him that. And as a consequence, as of today, from a counterterrorism perspective, from the security services perspective, there is a division of resources between still the Islamist extremism threat, which worldwide is still by far the greatest threat in terms of plots and casualties, but as well as a growing menace from the far right in Canada. So I think it's more of a more equitable division of resources, I would say, than we had in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, well, and I think I'll say a little bit about, you know, the specifics of the far right movement during that same period of time. I think the 90s was probably the last time that we saw, you know, sort of any kind of surge in activity around the far right. And that was around groups like the Heritage Front in particular, which were, you know, sort of little pockets across the country. There were other groups as well that were very active, but it was very short-lived. You know, there was infiltration that I think helped to dissolve them, if you will, or at least disperse them. And so things were pretty quiet until I would say into the 2010s with respect to the far right. I mean, again, there were small pockets popping up across the country, especially in Western provinces, and I would say in Western Ontario as well. And they continue really to be the hot spots, and I should say in parts of Quebec as well. So we actually did the first comprehensive study of the far right, three-year project, I guess, that we published in 2015. And I mean, the changes since then have just been so dramatic just in this very short period of time. At that time, we identified very conservatively, I will say, we identified just over 100 active groups across the country. And they really ranged in size from very small pockets of one, two, three, four, you know, half a dozen people to, you know, into the thousands in terms of online engagement anyway. So that's 2015 that we published. And of course, you know, 2015, 2016, we see the rise of Trump to the south of us in the US. And that really had a dramatic impact on the North American movement broadly, I would say. It really provided permission to hate and almost explicit. In some cases, you know, calls to and pandering to the far right. Many of you might remember this was later, you know, sort of later once he was elected in his term. But, you know, his call out to the Proud Boys to, you know, stand down and stand by in a public debate, televised debate, and which was, you know, not just messaging to the Proud Boys, but to the movement generally that, you know, at least tacitly he had they had his support. And I think that it really was, you know, Trump really lit the flame. I think, you know, things were bubbling. There were anxieties around immigration and migration and in particular, non-white, non-European immigration. The refugee crisis, as it was mislabeled, I would argue, in the Canadian context. And so, you know, these pieces sort of all came together to really create a surge. A dramatic growth in the number of far-right groups and individuals, I would say, as well. So we, you know, from that 100 in the last couple of years, we've identified now over 300 active groups. And, you know, those, they morph. So it's a moving target. It's really hard to quantify them. But, you know, in the order of hundreds now, I think. The other piece, though, is I mentioned individuals. So what we're also seeing is what many people in the current project, sort of the update of that study, are referring to as sort of an atomization of the movement. That is, more and more individuals who are coming to the far right movement, if you will, without necessarily affiliating with any particular group. So they're in and out of the social media platforms, for example, associated with the far right. You know, many of these, the lone actors in terms of the mass homicides that we've seen attributable to the far right in Canada, you know, we call them lone actors because they did act individually, but very much part of the movement in terms of their consumption of those narratives online. So we've seen that. We've also seen, I think, I hate to use this word, refinement of the movement in terms of the moving parts and what constitutes the movement now. That 2015 study, we were really focusing on very traditional elements, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and skinheads, and to some extent, sort of the anti-authority movement. Now we have all of those, plus the accelerationist movement, the specifically sort of anti-Muslim pillar, the misogynistic or, you know, manosphere pillar. What else have we got? The patriots and the militia, which have really the Canadian context, which is something really unusual for us. So, yeah, dramatic shifts, I think, quantitatively and qualitatively in what the movement looks like in Canada right now.
If I may, interestingly, on the Islamist side, we've seen sort of a same atomization that I think Barb talks about. A lot of people who do not belong to actual groups may be inspired by them, may claim to be. Most of the attacks that have taken place since 2015, 2014 have been by individuals who were part of the greater Islamist extremism universe, if I can use that term, but were not actually members of any kind of group and who simply act in its name. We've had people, you know, with ISIS flags on their dashboards running over people. We've had people who failed to join ISIS and as a consequence took out their frustrations and their anger here in Canada. So, and I think from security intelligence perspective, if I may weigh in on that, this makes it really hard. When you're trying to identify groups, that's one thing. You can infiltrate groups. You can put human sources in groups. You can't put human sources in individuals. It's much more difficult. You can certainly try to become a person's best friend and try to gain intelligence on them, but it is orders of magnitude harder to infiltrate a one person or two person cell than it is a group that has, let's say, a dozen or two dozen members. Barb mentioned the Heritage Front is a great example. We had those guys infiltrated up AZ back in the 1990s, which is probably one of the reasons why, and I think Barb used the term, like they were basically neutralized, I think, in the 1990s, in part because they've been infiltrated so heavily by the security services.
Okay. It's really interesting to hear that perspective, and it's also great to get that perspective from the practitioner and the academic. I kind of staying in the same theme and looking at evolution and change. Like you said, we've seen a definite kind of rise of the far right from 2015 on, especially looking at Trump. But in a smaller space and a shorter space, how do you think the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted, in particular, far right extremism? Like that, you spoke about the anti-government movements that are happening on a global scale. And also now we're seeing like COVID hoax, anti-vax, all of that kind of thing. So how do you think like just this specific, like the past 2 years have really impacted far-right extremism?
Oh, it's been an incredible boon for them. It's just, you know, the ways in which they've been able to exploit it and leverage COVID and all of the problems that that surround it. And I think the most important thing to think about it is that we're really seeing a convergence of different pieces and bits and elements coming together. So yeah, absolutely. We have the anti-authority movement on the left and the right and the center, you know, who are really, they're resistant to the lockdowns and vaccination mandates and all of those sorts of things. And then you have, you know, the conspiracy theorists who are filling in, you know, why we should resist this, you know, why the state is acting as it is. Oh, it's because the Jews have control, really, or it's because we're pandering to the Chinese and they're responsible for the virus and or it's a hoax. I mean, all those conspiracy theories play into this as well. Then you've got the far right, which has exploited the anti-statist elements as well as the conspiracy theories and really sort of latching on to those pieces and weaving their own narratives into that resistance. It's very much like what we saw in the Canadian context. In Europe, you're, you know, more familiar, of course, with the French variant of the Yellow Vests. In the Canadian context, they took a very different turn. It emerged as a very legitimate set of concerns, or out of a very legitimate set of concerns around threats to the energy sector and the oil industry in Alberta, well, Western provinces generally, but was very soon co-opted again. Mm-hmm. By the far right, scapegoating, you know, foreign ownership and scapegoating even immigrants in some odd ways in that context. And so the right is very deft at leveraging populist concerns and again overlaying their own discourses on top of that. And so also, you know, they drew in those existing movements, but then they also drew in individuals, you know, sort of random individuals who were, you know, not necessarily affiliated with any one of these other dimensions, but also had concerns about, you know, libertarian concerns, if you will, about loss of freedoms, as they describe them in terms of the lockdowns and the mandates, all of those sort of public health measures. So it really has provided incredible fodder for the far right to exploit the narratives and the anxieties, I think, that we all have around, you know, economic issues in particular, the number of jobs, hundreds of thousands, if not into the millions of jobs lost, thousands, tens of thousands of businesses closed down, with no sense of how many of those jobs will recover, how many, if any, of those businesses will recover. So all of that, you add in the social isolation, so, and the mental health problems associated with that. So you've got sort of another vulnerable group there that can be manipulated, if you will. So again, there, you know, as with any context, you know, there are multiple, multiple layers that are playing into that exploitation of COVID for nefarious, nefarious reasons.
I'll also just add quickly, Ava, what I find fascinating too, and I, you know, again, I defer to Barb. She really, I think she hit the nail on the head on what's happening in terms of the multiplicity of the actors involved in this. What I find really curious, and over the past 6 to 9 months, we've had an uptick in attacks, in, especially in Western Europe, attributable to Islamist extremists and some far right lone actor attacks. Now, there, and as Barb said, some of these cases, there have been some mental health issues. I'm thinking of the attack in Norway. We have, of course, the attack in Liverpool. That still remains to be seen what that actually was. But it strikes me as interesting that after a relatively calm period over the past, I'd say 12 to 18 months, we're now seeing an uptick. And this is something that I think that a lot of terrorist groups have been, you know, saying to people. I call it the Nike form of terrorism. Just do it. You know, you don't have to be part of us. You don't have to come and join us. You don't need special training with how to construct a suicide bomb. Pick up a knife from your butcher's block and walk into a store, walk into a commuter train. And these are the types of things we're seeing. And it's so the propaganda on that side is also, it also appears to be working. But I think it's too early to definitively say what this all means. But I do find it curious that, again, after that lull, we are seeing a bit of an uptick. Is it tied to the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the inspiration that that is given to extremists around the world? I don't know. Again, I think it's we need a lot more time to analyze this. But it certainly is something that I think bears watching going forward.
Yeah, no, we definitely agree. And like that, like you say, kind of going back to one of your points there, Barbara, a minute ago, is we're seeing a definite overlap. And I believe you spoke about earlier on, it was cafeteria terrorism, correct me if I'm wrong.
That's the term, yeah.
That would have been, yeah,
that would have been Phil. Yeah. So like that, how do you think it would work to create clearer definitions? Like that we're seeing far-right extremism, left-wing extremism, and Islamist inspired extremism, all picking and choosing different reasons to like justify their actions, and sometimes they tend to overlap. How would you create clear definitions, and also do you think it's helpful to create clear definitions, or could that be kind of icing some themes out or groups out in that sense?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, you know, what I mean, one of the things that we're seeing is an overlap in some respects in terms of, as I think that Phil suggested, right, an overlap across these movements. I mean, there are also anti-vaxxers and conspiracy theorists on the left. You know, many of those same conspiracy theories are being picked up by, you know, Islamist-inspired extremists as well. So that really muddies the waters in terms of trying to disentangle what terrorism extremism looks like. And I think it's not so much, you know, about necessarily clear definitions of any one of these, but I think a definition about around extremism and around terrorism. And what are the distinctions there? Even hate crime, right? I mean, I think I see all of these on a continuum, right? And it's a political decision very often in terms of what constitutes hate crime, what constitutes extremism, what constitutes terrorism. Jennifer Schwepp from University of Limerick and I just published a paper in Crime, Law, and Social Change that looks at exactly that. And we call it, oddly, continuum of hate. And it looks at sort of the parallels and some of the distinctions between things like hate crime, hate speech, microaggressions, extremism, terrorism, and sort of problematizes those relationships. So that's a real challenge. In the Canadian context, what the federal government has done now has turned from this notion of terrorism and identifying particular groups and talking about ideologically motivated violent extremism. And they refer to, you know, political, religious, ideological forms of terrorism, which, you know, tends to conflate all forms mm-hmm. of terrorism rather than specifying mm-hmm. them. So I think that's problematic. But is mm-hmm. I think it is, you know, again, a universal conversation yeah. that's going on is what are the distinctions among and between these? And I think it's really been highlighted in the Canadian context, given the number of, for us, the unprecedented number of mass homicides associated with variants of variants of right-wing extremism. Mm-hmm. So now there are 24 murders now attributable to, in mass murders attributable to far right extremism, which, you know, included, let's see, we start with, and people don't often recognize this one, but the shooting of three RCMP officers in Moncton by someone informed by anti-authority narratives, mm-hmm. right-wing anti-authority narratives. Then we had the mosque murders in Quebec City, six Muslim men killed. Then after that, we had the incel motivated attack, van attack in Toronto that killed initially 10 people just this week. An 11th
seven
died of their from their injuries. They'd been in hospital since the attack, and then most recently in this past year, four family members, Muslim family members, were killed again by a vehicular attack. So. So the problem in terms of defining is that, you know, there are ongoing debates about were these hate crimes, were these acts of terrorism, or were they extremist violence? And is that different from terrorism? I mean, in each of them, there were clear ideological motivations. There were clear, I wouldn't say, well, to some extent, political motivations. But I think the ideological piece was really what came to the fore in each of those. And I think that with the first couple, there was really not a lot of conversation about that. No, those are dating back now, you know, three, four years. Now, the more recent ones, I think there's been more open dialogue about mm-hmm. where do they lie on that spectrum. There's still no answer. I mean, neither hate crime, considerations in sentencing, nor terrorist related offenses were applied to any one of those. Mm-hmm. I think that weirdly, we did have a recent case. Was that last year? I think, Phil, where a young man who killed a woman and
in Toronto,
in a massage parlor in Toronto, was charged
with terrorism
offense. First time gender has been considered motivation, but it was just such an odd sort of test case, if you will. It was so not to dismiss the seriousness of it, but it was so unlike these other mass homicides we had, it sort of boggles the mind why that was one of the first ones where we'd gone down this road with right-wing extremism.
I like Barb's use of the word continuum, and that's exactly what it is. And I think what bothers me about the terminology being used now is, as Barb said, it conflates these things, and not in a helpful way. Again, speaking from a former practitioner's perspective, it doesn't help you to refer to this as IMVE or RMVE. You want to be as accurate as possible. Because I point out my introductory remarks, we have had different types of terrorism in the past. And, you know, calling the killing of two Turkish diplomats, you know, politically motivated violent extremism, when in fact they were Armenian extremists, why not call exactly what it was? Sikh extremism, I would argue, is both political and ideological and religious simultaneously. Which box do you put it in? I don't want to, you know, go into conspiracy theories as to why this terminology was used. I do think there's a political correctness to some of it. I just don't find it useful. Now, in fairness to the government, which is rare for me to say, they did say that they tried to reflect the legislation. So under the section 83.01 of the Canadian Criminal Code, an act of terrorism is a serious act of violence committed for political, ideological, or religious reasons. And in section 2C of the CSIS Act, which is what gives CSIS its mandate, they talk about political, religious, and ideological violence. So that's where the language is coming from. But when you're trying to investigate it, I don't see a usefulness, and I'm so happy that not only that Barb is here, but you know Barb regularly uses the terms, you know, far right extremism, right wing extremism, and for someone I think of her stature to continue to use this terminology, I think it's much more accurate. I think it's much more helpful. Definitional issues set aside, and I think Barb would agree. What does the far right mean? It means a million different things, a million different people, but it certainly is a lot more accurate than the what I would call the almost bland. Ideologically motivated violent extremism. Will it have an impact on operations? I don't know. It's hard to say, but you know, and the whole definition issue, you know, what is terrorism? I mean, that's been around for a very, very long time. Alex Schmidt from the ICCT in The Hague, you know, wrote famously that he found over 200 definitions internationally as to what terrorism is. The term is also almost cut to the point where it's not meaningless, but it's becoming meaningless in the sense that if you call too many things terrorism, then in essence, everything becomes terrorism, which means nothing becomes terrorism. And I would argue that we could even consider revoking terrorism as an offense under the criminal code, because A, it did not exist in Canada prior to 9/11. And that in terms from a judicial perspective, from a court perspective, this punishment for terrorism is that you kill somebody is actually the same as for first degree murder. Hence, there isn't a lot of incentive to call it terrorism. Although with hate crime provisions, which is a different part of the Canadian Criminal Code, Section 319, if you are found guilty of murder and it's determined that it was for hateful reasons, i.e. identified ethnic, sexual, gender group, the judge actually has some kind of parameters to extend your sentence if it's based on what is called a hate crime. So I think the dialogue is necessary. I just don't like this overgeneralization of the terminology. And as Barb said, you know, one man's hate crime is another man's act of terrorism. Mm. And it really muddies the waters, and I don't think in a helpful manner.
Where would you cut the line between a hate crime and a terrorist act?
That's up to you, Barb.
There is no, you know, hard and fast line there. And that's why I said it is a political decision in terms of, I mean, I struggle with it, right? Is it because of the intensity of the violence? Is it because of the number of victims? You know, because in many respects, you know, the ideological motivation underlies both hate crime and terrorism. So you can't just go with the definitions, the legal definitions of the two terms. So it is, you know, it's a very blurry, very broad line, not a fine line between the two. And it is, you know, it's historically and socially contingent as well. So that line is actually moving all of the time, depending on broader conversation. So again, bottom line, it is a political decision. Now, I think one of the other important things to think about in terms of not just the definition, but the application of the language to particular incidents is from a victim's perspective and the community's perspective as well. Mm-hmm. You know, even when it's something, you know, that it's very clearly a hate crime, you know, it's a simple assault on the street, gay man walks out of a bar and is, you know, called the F word and attacked, you know, that's very clearly a hate crime. And from that individual's perspective and from the community's perspective, it's very important to use that language, right? Mm-hmm. To acknowledge, to recognize the significance of that that particular incident as a message crime, right? So the symbolism is very important. I would say the same thing about terrorism. And this is, you know, especially in the last couple of cases that we've seen, last couple of incidents that we've seen, there have been calls to refer to them as terrorism as a means of, again, acknowledging the collective pain and the collective harm to the communities, and that this is not just a message crime, but is, you know, an attack on the community. So I think that's something that's often missed in the conversations, mm-hmm. is the importance to victims and targeted communities of the language that we use.
I think that's a really good point. I'm going to push back a little bit, Barb, in the sense that one thing that people often say is that terrorism is an attempt to instill fear or to instill terror in a community.
That's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. The problem with that is that you open yourself up to the possibility that in much of Canada, we suffer, and the greatest threat to public safety is not from hate crime, not from terrorism. It's probably more from either organized crime or gangs, street gangs in places like Vancouver and Toronto. There's no question that people that live in neighborhoods that are controlled and or dominated by street gangs live in a sense of fear. Their kids can't play on the street because they might get caught up in a drive-by shooting or whatever kind of thing. You could make the argument that street gangs are instilling fear into parts of Canadian society. And as a consequence, those communities are living in fear. And that if something bad happens, that you could almost apply a terrorism label to that. If in fact you see terrorism as instilling fear in society. But again, I think these are very, very open questions. I agree with Barb that much of this is political. It's also an attempt by the government to send a message to the communities and to Canadians writ large as to how they're going to treat these issues. But political determinations are not always the best ways, I think, to handle things, whether it's in the judicial system or within the broader security, intelligence, and law enforcement community. Awareness raising is always a fantastic thing to do. Training, you know, talking to people about what's happening, communities, engage with these communities to say how they're feeling. Absolutely 100%. But I hate slippery slope arguments. I think they're very, very convenient and not very well constructed. But, you know, I'll say it. I mean, you know, we've had some church burnings here in Canada in the aftermath of information that came out about mass burials in residential schools in Western Canada. I have not used the T word used to refer to those church burnings, but I mean, a case could be made if you know that these were acts of violence and they were probably politically motivated. Hence, that's covered under Section 83.01 of the Criminal Code. Or were they hate crimes? Were they hate crimes by people against churches, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church of Canada, for the treatment of First Nations children over the better part of a century? So despite the lack of consensus on definition, when we do use these terms in public, they do have an impact. And they do open you up to possibilities of having them implied in areas where they're maybe are not best to be used. So just a bit of caution. I think the conversation has to continue in this regard. And I think people have to be a little more careful in terms of how they label things. But I'm with Barb. I mean, you know, the division between hate crime and terrorism, I mean, that's about as fuzzy as you're going to get. And it's not a sense saying that this is the line. You know, you're on this side, you're this, you're on this side, you're not. I wish it were to work that way. It'd be a lot simpler for people like Barb to do her job, I'm sure, as well as the courts, but I don't think we're going to get there anytime soon.
And staying in that same vein, like you said, there's definitely a difficulty with the use of the word terrorism or extremism from a legal and political perspective. Would you actually encourage a universally agreed definition of terrorism and of extremism also? Or do you think that could be a little messy in some cases?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think that you'll ever get there. Who's going to decide? I mean, you say a universal declaration decided by whom? Are you going to strike a body to say of, you know, practitioners and academics and policy people to say, we will come up with the definition of the T word? Well, good luck with that. It'd be, you know, I don't know. It'd be like the five men with the elephant, right? Depending on what aspect of the word you're looking at, you come up with a different definition. So we've failed so far, Eva. The UN has failed. You know, the US has failed. The EU has failed on agreeing on a consensus of terrorism. So I don't see it happening anytime soon. And in a perfect world, if we could agree 100% on what those parameters were, absolutely. I just don't see us getting that place anytime soon.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not sure, you know, what purpose it would serve to do that. Yeah. Even, you know, I think it would amount essentially to the imposition of one set of values over another set of values, depending on the context. I mean, it's the same conversation. You know, I'm a criminologist, sort of by training. You know, that's the basic issue around defining crime, right? That it is socially and historically contingent. It reflects the values of a particular country or a particular nation state. And I think terrorism, any kind of, you know, legislation of any sort of criminal behavior has to reflect the values of that particular ethnic enclave, if you will, or nation state. So I think it would be a challenge, and perhaps not something that we necessarily want to do, to impose a definition on all comers.
I'm so glad that Barb raised the criminology side. I mean, you think about it. You know, 100 years ago, wife abuse was not a crime in many societies. It was accepted behavior, which is abominable if you think about it. But now, of course, it's encoded in our criminal codes. But, you know, to arrest someone for this 100 years ago would have been unheard of. So things do evolve over time. And I think terrorism, our understanding of terrorism is evolving. It's evolving over the past 20 years from it's all about 9/11, that's terrorism, to now it's a little more amorphous. It's a little more inclusive of a whole bunch of things. But my concern, as I said earlier, is it's becoming too amorphous. And I think when you allow things to expand too far, you're really losing the sense as to what the term was used for in the first place. I mean, the term only really dates back to the French Revolution of the 1790s. That's when the first terrorism occurred, you know, in modern vocabulary, you know, the reign of terror in that decade. That's a very different, in fact, I wouldn't have called what happened in the 1790s in France terrorism. That was classically an insurrection against the state, you know, against the monarchy. But that's the origins of the term. And, you know, I say facetiously that, you know, sharks terrorize people. Does that mean that sharks are terrorists? Well, no, sharks don't have intent. I haven't asked a shark lately on what its intent. It wasn't biting people.
Its intent is to get fed, yeah.
Or spiders or snakes or whatever kind of thing, right? So it's, I think, again, Barb hit the nail on the head. It really is a political use of the term. And there's an agenda there. Again, I'm not being a conspiracy theorist, but there's an agenda there when the term is used, when the term is not. For a guy, you know, a wannabe ISIS guy to have an ISIS flag on his car, to take inspiration from ISIS and run over a police officer in Edmonton in 2017 and then run down five people on Jasper Ave in Edmonton later, and to not be charged with terrorism. He was charged with attempted murder and he actually got a fairly lengthy sentence. What does that tell you about how the courts are treating terrorism? Interesting question.
I'm just going to provide a little bit of context to the listeners. So what you were referring to, the first time the term terrorism appeared with a modern concept of it was during the French Revolution, and especially during the Robespierre King of Terror. Yeah. And I also want to ask, at an international level, we do see a little bit of cooperation inside the United Nations. At least we have the UN list of designated terrorist groups. And Canada oftentimes goes well beyond the list of designated groups. You are one of the few countries in the world that actually designated Proud Boys as a terrorist organization. So what is your take on whether the list is actually useful, whether it's harmful, and in general about international cooperation on definitions of terrorism and such?
I'll go first because the Canadian list
has been used to vilify Muslim communities for however long we've had it. Until last year, 2 years ago, virtually all the groups that were listed were Muslim groups. There were a couple of Tamil groups and what else, maybe a Sikh group or two on there. And so it was a heavily, heavily biased instrument. And, you know, so in recent years, we've seen now, what are we up to? 7, 5 designated groups, far right.
18,
groups.
Yeah.
The first one was, it was low hanging fruit. It was Blood and Honor, who have a history in the UK, the US, less so in Canada, but a lengthy history of just horrific violence. And they're very explicit. They're very aggressive in their language. So that was, you know, that was an easy one, an obvious choice. And then we come to the more recent designations. Proud Boys, really? That one just, I think because they were so visible, right? And, you know, Trump calling them out, you know, they were, again, low-hanging fruit in the sense that, you know, they were very much in the public eye. And, you know, it was, again, sort of an easy designation. What's the consequence of it, though? I mean, you know, aside from with that vilification I referred to earlier on, the consequences, because it's really about, you know, one of the key issues is that it enables then freezing of assets and all of that sort of activity. Most of these groups don't have a lot of assets to freeze. So pragmatically, it doesn't really have much of an impact. Symbolically, perhaps it does send a message. We're finally paying attention to these actors. Beyond that, I'm not sure what impact it has, because some of these groups, I mean, in fact, it can have counter effects, in the sense that they'll regroup, you know, under another name. We've seen the Proud Boys already. You do see, you know, rats fleeing the sinking ship, right? So the folks, a lot of people did leave and say, oh, this isn't what I signed on for. Mm-hmm. But what happens is what's left behind are the most intransigent, right? Mm-hmm. Who are going to dig in their heels even further. So it can elevate them. This is a mark of pride for some of these groups to have been designated like that, Base and Atomwaffen, for example. It's a political, political move. It's not going to have much concrete impact, I don't think. Well, I shouldn't say that, because what it's also allowed is social media companies to say they've been designated, therefore we have justification for that. So it has had that impact to take them off mainstream media, social media, and put them into their own little fringe platforms. So I guess it has had some concrete consequences, but it certainly isn't going to halt the stem the flow or stem the surge of the movement.
With the sole exception of, I don't like the term vilification because I think that the groups that were listed in the 2000s were terrorist groups, and they're mostly Al-Qaeda and Islamic State affiliates.
I'm not denying that. I'm saying it was sort of a blanket condemnation.
I do agree with Barb. It does help with financing. If you're dumb enough to write a check to the Proud Boys, then you deserve to have your assets frozen as far as I'm concerned. I agree with Barb that being named a group can actually raise your profile. You're important enough to be named. Wow, you guys, you know, I want to be part of those guys kind of thing. It did help us in the sense that from an investigative perspective, that if you wanted to go after somebody, you know, to investigate somebody, and you could show that they were a member of Group A and Group A was listed, it would often facilitate getting a warrant, for example, to intercept someone's communications under a federal court procedure. The problem, of course, is what does a member mean? Are there membership cards? Mm-hmm. Do you have a number? Do you have a tattoo somewhere on your body that shows you're a member of the Proud Boys or Al-Qaeda? It's highly problematic. And it is very political. So for many years, I used to, was a specialist on Iran. And there's an Iranian terrorist group called Mujahideen-e-Khalq, MEK, or MKO, which is against the Iranian regime. They have been since the 1970s. And they were listed in Canada. And the Harper government delisted them back in 2011. And my question was, why? They're still around. They're still planning attacks against the Iranian regime. Now, I'm not a fan of the Iranian regime, but they were a terrorist group, and the decision was made to delist them to put pressure on Iran or to send a message. I have no idea. And then more recently, we have a huge conundrum here in Canada. The Taliban is a listed terrorist entity in Canada. The Taliban now runs Afghanistan. And if you're following news lately, how much is it? Like 4/5 of Afghans are faced with starvation right now. If we don't get more food and money into Afghanistan, if we send money to the Taliban regime to help feed the Afghan people and avoid a famine, we are actually supporting a listed terrorist entity. That there is an interesting thing to have to deal with from a legal perspective. From my perspective, having worked with the security service, I could care less who or what was on the terrorist listing. It didn't affect the investigations that I was part of. It didn't affect the prioritization of the investigations. And frankly, I think Barb pointed the Proud Boys, that was solely a knee-jerk reaction to the Capitol attack on January the 6th. I like to say that groups like the Proud Boys, for the most part, couldn't organize a piss up in a bar. You know, I'm not saying that they're not some nasty bunch of people, but granting them a listing on the terrorist entities is to me, it's a purely sop to whatever the soup of the day was at the time. And I don't see it being useful at all.
Okay, and kind of starting towards almost a bit of a wind down, what advice would you give to people who want to start a career in the field of far-right extremism and counterterrorism more generally, both maybe as a practitioner or academic?
Come to Ontario Tech to do your PhD. But I mean, seriously, you know, if you are a burgeoning academic and looking for programs, I think it's, you know, there's in the Canadian context in particular, there's so few of us working in this space. Mm-hmm. So, there are some folks at Simon Fraser University in BC. There are some folks at Laval and Université de Montréal working in this space. So, you know, find the people who are leading the field and engage with them. Even if you're not, you know, if you don't going to go to that university, not going to train under them, I think it's important to engage in those networks that are emerging. And I think we really do have a very strong network in the Canadian context, and I would say even internationally, looking at working in this space around right-wing extremism specifically, a much broader, of course, community looking at extremism and terrorism writ large, but within right-wing extremism, we're a pretty, I wouldn't say close-knit, but, you know, it's a pretty tight network. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the most important thing, is to be engaged in those networks in some way. So we have, in the Canadian context, TSIS, which is the Canadian Centre on Terrorism, Security and Society, which is, you know, burgeoning there. At our own Centre on Hate, Bias and Extremism, we have the Global Network on Hate, which is, you know, hate, it's sort of across hate studies, but extremism is an important part of that. The International Network for Hate Studies is another sort of entity there. Again, hate studies, but, you know, extremism is an important part of that. There's the C-Rex network out of Norway as well. So, you know, getting engaged in those formal and informal networks, a really important way to engage here and put yourself out there, right, at the conferences, you know, begin publishing in, you know, the core journals in this space, but also not just the terrorism journals, but the hate studies journals, of which there are very few. So, you know, thinking, I guess that's the other piece, right, is think of it as part of a broader, and I guess it depends on your orientation. Is it part of hate studies, or is it part of terrorism studies, or is it a Venn diagram where all of those pieces are that? So, you know, don't narrow yourself to just this space of right-wing terrorism studies or right-wing extremism studies. It's embedded in, especially the way I come to it, it's embedded in hate studies more so than terrorism studies.
If you're a burgeoning scholar, email Bart. That'd be my advice to you. Very, very simple. I think from a practitioner perspective, I would certainly recommend anyone who wants to work in national security / public safety, from a Canadian perspective, you know, consider my former organization, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. I had a job where, in all honesty, I couldn't wait to get to work every morning for 32 years. It was ever changing. It was exciting. It was challenging. There's a lot to be done on this front. It's never enough resources to do it. So if there are people, young Canadians, who are thinking about this, I even offer advice to people who are looking for jobs in this field. They can contact me. We can have a conversation about this. It's a long process. It's not just an email to Barb. It does take a long time to get your application looked at. And of course, there's all series of interviews and stuff. But this is an important part of it. I mean, the security service is there for a reason. And when it was taken out of the old RCMP service back in 1984, CSIS serves as what I would call an early warning system, because it has the authority under its legislation to look at individuals and groups before it becomes a criminal matter. We need reasonable grounds to suspect rather than reasonable grounds to believe, which is the criminal threshold under Canadian law, which means you get involved in looking at, you know, what threat, if any, does this pose? And then if you decide that there's no there, then you sort of move on to the next one. Some people would say that as an infringement on Canadian rights and freedoms. I beg to differ. We have a very biased position. But I think that the types of information that CSIS can gather can actually facilitate, you know, later on criminal investigations that will lead to people, stop people from doing very, very bad things. So highly, highly recommend that, you know, from the terrorism, counterterrorism perspective, things, as we've said in the earlier on in the conversation, have changed rapidly over the past 5 to 6 years in the Canadian landscape, and they're just going to keep changing. Predicting is the wrong word. I'm worried about eco-terrorism being the next big thing to come around. If the perception is that COP26 didn't result in anything, the planet's going down the toilet, no one's taking this thing seriously, and there's a big movement of theirs, or these people aren't terrorists, they're heroes. Well, one man's hero is another man's terrorist. That's going to be a whole other challenge for the security service to determine what threat do we get from people blowing up oil facilities, for example, targeting coal trains, maybe even taking, you know, CEOs of major energy companies kidnapped to try to get them to stop doing what they're doing. So it's there's a lot of work to do. It's a fascinating field, and I would highly recommend any Canadian who wants to look into those particular avenues to. Don't email Barb in that regard. Email me, and I'd be more than happy to talk to you.
I do want to put in another plug for folks who, you know, are sort of practitioners, but more on the policy or the research side. And that is in Public Safety Canada, the Canada Centre for Community Engagement and Prevention of Violence. It's a very long title, but it is sort of, I would argue right now, it's sort of one of the focal areas through which we funnel a lot of research around far-right extremism in Canada. I mean, it's, you know, its mandate is much broader than that. It's, you know, extremism, terrorism of all sorts and other threats to public safety. But it really has, you know, growing strength in the area of far-right extremism specifically. And they're always looking for people in the policy field and the research field. So that's absolutely a great place for, you know, young folks looking for jobs in that area.
So for people that are looking into getting more in-depth into the topic, I would like to ask you our traditional final question, which is if each of you could recommend a book and or a film or a documentary on the topic.
In the Canadian context, I don't know that we have any documentaries or videos on right-wing extremism specifically. Well, I shouldn't say that. CBC actually did a great documentary featuring our coordinator for the Center on Hate, Bias, and Extremism, Brad Galloway, looking at, gosh, I can't remember what the name of the documentary was now, but it was CBC Canada, if people want to look there. So it looked at, you know, the life of or the sort of life trajectory, if you will, of a member of the far right movement. So, you know, sort of tracing his entry into the movement, his entry and his time in the movement, and then his exit, and, you know, what he's done since then in terms of the work he does around countering radicalization to the far right. So that is probably the only sort of full length one that comes readily to mind. In terms of literature, I mean, you know, Ryan Scrivens and I, he was my research assistant at the time on the first far right project. We did publish that with Belgrave, Right Wing Extremism in Canada. So that's something to look at in the Canadian context. A really nice edited collection that just came out, I think, with Routledge, is researching the radical right, researching the far right. And Aaron Winter and Graham Macklin were two of the editors of that that volume. Oh, and actually coming out soon, also with Belgrave in the Hate Studies series, Ryan Scrivens, myself, and Jeff Grunwald from the U.S. are publishing a volume, edited volume, on right-wing extremism in Canada and the U.S. So watch this space for that. So those are the ones that come most readily to mind, specific to right-wing extremism.
I'm going to be very, very selfish and just point to this little book right here. This is my sixth book that I've written since my retirement from the Security Service, called The Peaceable Kingdom, A History of Terrorism in Canada from Confederation to the Present. It is the history of terrorism from our founding as a nation, from the viewpoint of practitioners. So I did not have Barb's academic background by any stretch of the imagination, but I told the story. My sources are all former RCMP and CSIS officers who worked in counterterrorism in Canada. I couldn't find any sources for the Fenians in the 1860s because they're all dead, but I did end up with David Wilson, who's a professor at the University of Toronto and is the Fenian, because the first act of terrorism in Canada was carried out by Fenian extremists in 1868. We weren't even a year old as a country when we had an act of terrorism when a member of Parliament was assassinated. But I had people that worked at the FLQ in the Quebec in the 1960s. I had people that worked Air India, who worked the Armenians, who worked the far right in the 90s. Of course, who worked the Islamist files in the 2010s and 2015 and 2010s. So if you want to learn about not only about terrorism in Canada as the practitioners saw it, and I do leverage my own experience working on Islamist files for the better part of 15 years, it's also, for to your earlier question, if you're interested in a career in security intelligence in Canada, it's probably the only book I think that's been published by a former practitioner talking to those. It gives you an insight as to what it's like to work at CSIS, what the challenges are, what the environment's like, and things like that. So, and it's Christmas coming up. I can't think of any more appropriate gift under the Christmas tree than a book on terrorism to your favorite loved one. And if you do, you have to order it through me, because it is, so far it's only self-published. I'm working on getting it on Amazon, but it'll be signed. So you get a signed copy under the Christmas tree, and it'll just bring squeals of joy from your four-year-olds on Christmas morning.
I expect a Christmas present for you, Phil. Come on.
It's on its way, Bart.
With a bow.
Took on terrorism as a Christmas present. Everybody around me was like, what? But I was so happy. So thank you so much, both of you, for having joined us in this episode. And congratulations, Ava, on having made it safely to the end of your first ever as a host.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thumbs up. I hope all went well.
We'll give you a passing grade.
I really enjoyed it. Great conversation. Yeah. And I really appreciate the opportunity.
Welcome to a new episode of the Activism Academy podcast with me, Miriam Fanin. First of all, welcome to our new co-host, Ava Callanan. Today, we will continue our series on far-right extremism, focusing on the Canadian extremism landscape. We are joined by Dr. Barbara Perry, the director of the Center of Hate, Bias and Extremism, who has written extensively in the area of hate crime and right-wing extremism. Our second guest is Phil Gursky, president of the Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. Phil has been working for more than a decade with the Canadian Security Intelligence Service.